Ken Wilber is a contemporary American philosopher who has written a host of books related to what he calls his integral theory. Who's sort of heard of Ken Wilber or read any of his many, many books? All right. Many of which say the same things. We'll get to that. So one way to write a lot of books is to repeat yourself and just add a little more, right? But in general, I find many of his frameworks for thinking about the world both helpful personally as well as particularly relevant for contemporary Unitarian Universalism. As that name integral theory implies, Wilber seeks to integrate the best of all available sources of knowledge and experience related to any given field. This postmodern approach is related to our big tent of Unitarian Universalism. As UUs, we have not just one source or even two or three sources. We have six very broad sources that we draw on. And we insist that we're actually stronger because of this diversity. We celebrate that mystics and social justice advocates, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, and Taoists, humanists and scientists, pagans and representatives of indigenous spiritualities are all together in the same community. We challenge one another to take into account multiple perspectives. We keep one another accountable and work together to build the beloved community. And for me, Ken Wilber's integral theory, I would say I am a fan of Ken Wilber. I am not a fanboy. Some people are sort of in the cult of Ken Wilber and think he's got it all figured out. So I think he's helpful, but, we can qualify these things. But he has been one among many helpful ways of thinking about how all these different perspectives, how they relate, and how we can potentially integrate them together. If you're interested in learning more, back in 2007, he released a very short introduction with lots of pictures and charts to his perspective called The Integral Vision, so that could be a good starting point. If you want to go deeper, particularly in the area of religion on the theory side, I recommend his book Integral Spirituality. On the more practice side, if you're interested more in practice than in theory, he's released a book called Integral Life Practice that has sort of a lot of real practical ways of how might we integrate and actually live this stuff out. The only thing I'll say about the Integral Life Practice book is I find his perspective it's been criticized as sort of masculinist, like very, very strong, robust, and it's almost like oppressive, I think, in a sense, because he really emphasizes kind of growing in all areas of your life all at once, integrating them, and I'm like, that is exhausting, you know, whereas I think more realistically, if you're training for a marathon, that may not be the time to start working on, writing a book, or if you just had a baby or started a new job, maybe you that's not also the time necessarily to go deeply into therapy and, your own child, I think sometimes we have to balance these things out. And again, while I have no intention of trying to read everything Wilber has written, not for the least of which reasons that he often repeats himself from book to book, there is one book by him that I'll just note briefly that I haven't read but do plan to read soon. It's called Grace and Grit. It's about his journey with his wife, who was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1983, 10 days after their wedding. She died of the disease 6 years later in 1989, and Grace and Grit is his writing and sort of working through that incredibly tragic experience. But for this morning specifically, I'd like to invite us to wrestle some with the insights in Wilber's latest book, which is called The Fourth Turning in Buddhism, Imagining an Evolution of an Integral Buddhism. It's currently available only by ebook, but eventually it'll be released in a longer form as a actual book, if that's your preference. And I appreciate his interest in tracing these turning points in the history of the Buddhist tradition. For those who are interested, Phyllis Tickle has done a similar thing in her book, The Great Emergence, in tracing turning points in Christianity. I also just learned, this is sort of tragic, that Phyllis Tickle has been diagnosed with cancer. She's really been a lion in she was like the first religion editor of Publishing Weekly. It's hard to overemphasize, for those who know the role she's played, the influence she's had in the religious publishing industry in the last few decades. She's also just a very kind, compassionate person who will certainly be missed. But she's traced a similar evolution in the turning points of Christianity, the ways that kind of radical shifts happened in the Christian tradition in the wake of the Emperor Constantine's conversion to Christianity in the Middle Ages, then with the Reformation, and then again in our current age, in which some people describe as Google is the new Gutenberg. In the ways that Johannes Gutenberg invented the movable type printing press in 1455, and that allowed, it's not a coincidence that, right, less than a little over 50 years later, the Protestant Reformation happened, right, as people suddenly had copies, you could print copies of these tracts and print copies of the 95 Theses, print copies of the Bible in a way. And now Google is the new Gutenberg, because our information age and having, you know, access and being able to get data is really transforming all parts of our society, including religion. So Wilbur and other scholars have traced a similar paradigm shifts in the history of Buddhism. The first turning starts with the historical Siddhartha Gautama himself, the historical Buddha. Buddha is a title, right? That's not, you know, Christ is not Jesus' last name. Buddha is not Jesus' is the title that means awakened one, right? Mahatma is not Gandhi's name. It's Mohandas, right? But it's a title meaning the great one. So the historical Buddha who lived and taught in India sometime around the 5th century BCE, so that's about 500 years before the historical Jesus, was the historical Buddha. And this first turning is probably best represented today if any of you are familiar with the Theravadan Buddhist tradition. It's probably most similar to the original historical teachings of the Buddha. The second major turning of the Buddhist wheel of Dharma, the sort of way of being in the world, is often traced to the teachings of the Buddhist philosopher Nagarjuna. And he's actually very much worth reading and is a philosopher that really focused on what does this emptiness mean, this teaching of emptiness at the Laura played some with that emptiness fullness. What he really did a lot of work around emptiness and what that means. And that was around like 150, 250 CE. About 100 century or two after Jesus. And that's within the Mahayana school of Buddhism. A third great turning from around the same time is the Yogacara school. And all of these turnings represent major paradigm shifts that led to new innovations and new insights. And depending on how you want to count, some people also look at the tantric or esoteric school of Buddhism as an additional turning. So maybe Wilbur should be calling his book The Fifth Turning. But that's, you know, not, it doesn't really matter, because what Wilbur is trying to do is say, regardless of how many turnings came before, how do we draw on the best of all of them as well as the best of 21st century knowledge to inform a 21st century Buddhist practice in an age in which Google is the new Gutenberg. So Wilbur's phrase, and to me this is actually deeply resonant and particularly potentially helpful for how we think about the six sources. He says that our invitation is to transcend and include. He's saying what can often sometimes be the case is we want to go beyond, but then we exclude. We want to say, and you throw the baby out with the bathwater is the stereotype there. He says, how do we transcend and include? In other words, transcend the limitations of previous paradigms so that you're no longer constrained by obsolete teachings, but also include the parts of the tradition that remain valuable. And that desire, again, to transcend and include is at its best what we do with our six sources, to try to include the traditions we've inherited from the past while also transcending their limitations to create a new whole worthy of the 21st century and all that we know. Said differently, when you join a UU congregation, you're invited to bring the best of everything with you. You don't have to leave behind your Judaism or your Christianity or your Hinduism or any of that. You can bring all of that with you, whatever remains helpful, while also letting go what feels to you now obsolete. And as I've been reflecting on what it could mean to create a 21st century pragmatic Buddhism, there are at least three touchstones that I want to briefly mention today that can help guide our way forward for those of you who do feel drawn to some form of Buddhist practice. The first is to realize that I think in the West we can kind of naively approach Buddhism as it's sort of this pure, perfect thing that doesn't have any of those messy corruptions of Christianity or, you know, whereas some people find when they go to traditional Buddhist countries, they get really into Buddhism and they want to go to like Myanmar or Japan and they find that, whoa, Buddhism has patriarchy too, and Buddhism has, so a lot of these same problems. That in the West, for the most part, we're more familiar with the shadow sides of the Christian tradition or the Jewish tradition or the Islamic tradition. Such as, you know, the Crusades or the Inquisition or Islamic terrorism that we see today. But Buddhism, just as with any religion or philosophy, can also be perverted and has been used to cause violence, to cause oppression, to cause division. To name just three examples from our world today, with not even going into history, in a recent article in the Washington Post noted that in Sri Lanka, where about 70% of the population is Theravadan Buddhist, a group of monks formed the Budu Balasena, or the Buddhist Power Force, in 2012 to protect the country's Buddhist culture. That force, nicknamed the BBS, carried out at least 241 attacks on Muslims and 61 attacks on Christians in 2013. In Myanmar, at least 300 Rohingya Muslims whose ancestors were migrants from Bangladesh have been killed and up to 300,000 displaced by nationalistic Buddhists. Ashin Warathru, a monk who describes himself as the Burmese bin Laden, is encouraging the violence by encouraging people. He's sort of scapegoating these Muslims as invaders, and we've seen this sort of dynamic play out in different ways in other countries. And in the Buddhist-majority Thailand, at least 5,000 people have died in Muslim-Buddhist violence in the country's south. The country's Knowing Buddha Foundation is not a violent group, but it advocates for a blasphemy law that would punish anyone who offends the faith as they sort of interpret Buddhism. It wants Buddhism declared a state religion and portrays popular culture as a threat to believers. So it's not just, you know, so there are terrible sides of Islam, but there are also beautiful sides of Islam, like the Sufi tradition. You know, there are terrible parts of Judaism in which, like the Book of Joshua, and then there are, you know, kill everyone, but then there are beautiful parts of Judaism as well. So it's like all these religions and philosophies have good and bad sides. And so much depends on what an individual or a community brings to a tradition, as far as whether any given tradition and the way it's used leads to liberation or to oppression. A perspective from the fourth turning of Buddhism challenges us to take responsibility for letting go of those obsolete parts of religions that are oppressive, that are anachronistic, that are heterosexist, sexist, classist, any of these things. But to hold on to and emphasize the parts that continue to be of great value. In the case of Buddhism, for example, it's an incredibly powerful set of practices for cultivating compassion, clarity, concentration, equanimity. It's incredibly powerful and valuable for that. So that's my first touchstone, to be aware that the Buddhist tradition has all the same promises and perils of all the other religions and philosophies. The second touchstone, if you do feel drawn, as I am, toward Buddhist practices, is to be wary of what is sometimes called spiritual materialism, the ways that spiritual traditions like Buddhism can be co-opted and commodified to support oppressive systems instead of transforming them, which is their fuller promise. To name only the most recent example that comes to mind, are any of you fans of the television show Mad Men? Any Mad Men watchers out there? All right, did anybody seen the series finale that just came on? So if you haven't, sounds like y'all aren't huge Mad Men fans. That's fine. I've watched it on and off. My wife is a huge Mad Men fan. So I'm going to spoil just the very end. But for those of you, Mad Men is a very – I really don't feel bad about this because if you really cared, you would have already seen it. But the second thing is that Mad Men, if you don't know, is a very character-driven show, so it's spoiling one plot point is not anyway. So if you don't want to know, just say la 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 for about 30 seconds. So that being said, the final scene has the protagonist, this advertising man, Don Draper, having a spiritual awakening on an oceanfront at this outdoor sunrise meditation class. They're not actually filming at Esalen, but it's you're led to think that it's at the Esalen Institute, which is in Big Sur, California. It was really at the center of the human potential movement in the 60s. You can still visit Esalen today. But that scene closes with the class, including Don, sitting in this meditation posture over this beautiful oceanfront vista. They're chanting Om. And, you know, Don, of course, has, you know, been through all these dramas and all of this. And as the camera zooms in on this sort of blissed out, beatific, peaceful face of Don Draper, you begin to hear the voiceover of that famous 1961 Coca-Cola ad, "I'd like to buy the world a Coke." And then it cuts to that. So you're led to think that what Don actually got out of this experience was a great idea for selling Coca-Cola. And that ad, as some of you will remember, shows young people from all over the world gathered on this beautiful hilltop in Italy. They're holding, none of them are drinking Coke, but they're all holding open bottles of Coca-Cola, and they sing together, and it starts off pretty good. "I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love, grow apple trees and honeybees." Can you kind of hear this in your head? And snow white turtle doves. "I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony." And it's really a beautiful song, these young people singing this. I'd like to buy the world a Coke, which is great if you own stock in Coca-Cola, and keep it company. That's the real thing. What the world wants today is the real thing. And of course, that's Coke's line, right? We're the real thing. For what it's worth, I think it was a great ending to the show, confronting us with a strong example of the manipulative power of advertising. So it's kind of like if you take a half step back, you realize how deeply you're being manipulated, even as you can't help yourself from being manipulated from having these incredibly powerful, often positive associations with Coca-Cola, right? And you've seen Coke do this in various other ads. They just have the great, you know, catchy music, people bouncing around, having good times, and the whole idea is just to have positive associations with their brand. And that jingle, that song, I'd like to sing the world a Coke, I mean, it's such an earworm. It just kind of gets in your head. The harmony is beautiful. This mountaintop scene with young people is moving. And again, it starts out with this great, powerful, good sentiment. I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. You know, that would change the world. I mean, that's sort of the basis of Habitat for Humanity, right? That everyone deserves a simple, decent place to live. But so they take that good sentiment and they're sort of saying, no, equally important as buying the world a home is buying the world a Coke, right? And that Coke, that's the real thing. What the world wants, it's the real thing. So again, you take a half step back, and we all sort of know on some level that could anything be less of the real thing than a high fructose corn syrup, artificially caramel-colored soda? I mean, other than the real thing for contributing to obesity and type 2 diabetes. Can I say that without getting a letter from Coke's lawyer? We will find out. Dunn, or really a real-life ad man, has taken the beauty of human compassion and of joining together across traditional divisions and strongly associated it with Coca-Cola through these powerful images and this harmonious jingle. And there's a lot more, again, to say about that advertising phenomena, but my point for this morning is that just as Buddhism and other spiritual traditions can be subject to various fundamentalisms, they can also be commodified in ways that support broken, exploitative systems instead of fulfilling their promises for transforming us and our way of being together in the world. I would even invite you to consider that this whole sort of mindfulness-based stress reduction movement, which as a whole is creating a lot of good in the world, you can also, if you take, again, a half step back, you can see the ways in which it's being manipulated to say, oh, keep overworking, just add 30 minutes of meditation so that you are not, you know, less likely to die from stress so you can keep working 80-hour, 100-hour work weeks longer, right? So do you see the ways in which mindfulness-based stress reduction is being commodified as opposed to the deeper promise of Buddhism is a much more radical transformation about having, through meditating, having these insights into the impermanent nature of reality, into our relationship to unsatisfactoriness and suffering in our life, of realizing that there's a certain sense in which we don't have a self that is permanent, and deeply realizing what we UUs call the interdependent web of all existence and living very deeply out of that and how that can transform the ways we try to stay in right relationship with each other. So yes, good things can come from mindfulness-based stress reduction, but to think that that's Buddhism or the full promise of it is a lie. I mean, there's so much more potential. So as I move toward my conclusion, allow me to offer a third and final touchstone that points us a little more toward the actual real thing of Buddhism. So related to spiritual materialism is sometimes called spiritual bypass. And that is, many people naively again come to Buddhism for the hope that they'll be able to find a way to live without vulnerability and risky, deep, empathetic compassion. That they can sort of just be in some blissed out state all the time, or they can sort of numb out. And that's actually not what Buddhism will do to you. It's the opposite of what authentic Buddhist practice leads to, which is connection, compassion, and interdependence. So if it's leaving you just always blissed out or numbed out, you're doing it wrong. And we can talk about that. The Buddhist teacher Stephen Levine says it this way: if prayer would do it, I'd pray. If reading esteemed thinkers would do it, I'd be halfway through the patriarchs already. If discourse would do it, I'd be sitting with His Holiness every moment He was free. If contemplation would do it, I'd have translated the periodic table to hermit poems, converting matter to spirit. If even fighting would do it, I'd have a black belt. If anything other than love could do it, I'd have done it already, but I've left the hardest for last. And following the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we often talk about our goal as creating the beloved community, which means through love and compassion, breaking down walls and forming bonds between people who previously perceived themselves as unable to be anything but enemies. So breaking down those bonds and creating community, that is what it means to create the beloved community. And to consider what it means to talk about the beloved community from a Buddhist perspective, there's a powerful quote from the contemporary Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh that C. Raven reminded me of this past week as we were planning this service. Of note, a year before his assassination, Dr. King wrote to the Nobel Committee, "As the Nobel Peace Prize laureate of 1964, I now have the pleasure of proposing to you the name of Thich Nhat Hanh for that award in 1967. I do not personally know of anyone more worthy of the Nobel Peace Prize than this gentle Buddhist monk from Vietnam." They didn't actually give out any awards that year, but we do have the letter that MLK wrote and about his relationship with Thich Nhat Hanh. So Hanh has written that the Buddha, and this kind of gets to some of the turnings in Buddhism, Hanh wrote that the historical Buddha predicted that the next Buddha would be the Buddha of love. But Hanh says, kind of from this 21st century perspective, it is possible that the next Buddha, the coming Buddha, will not take the form of an individual, that the awakening will actually take the form of a community, what Buddhists call a sangha. A community practicing understanding and loving kindness. A community practicing mindful, you could even say also heartful, living. And the practice can be carried out as a group, as a city, as a nation, as a world, as a cosmos, is eventually our invitation. May we at UUCF, as individuals and us collectively, be part of creating such beloved communities. We can't control the vicissitudes of the world, but we can learn to respond to whatever comes our way with greater mindfulness, greater heartfulness, greater insight, greater compassion. And for this morning, I leave you with this Buddhist blessing for the coming days and weeks. May you be filled with loving kindness. May you be filled with loving kindness. May you be well. May you be peaceful and at ease. May you be whole.